Okay, welcome, Mr. Friendly. And Gil, I think, is going to lead off because he's got some questions about the First Amendment he wants to ask you with regard to your book, The Minnesota Rag.
Well, I think one of the first things that came to me while reading this book, and it's one of the things you point out, First Amendment cases, which is so unfortunate when you're trying to gain sympathy of the public, so often revolve around totally despicable people, or cases where people find a hard time feeling any sympathy. We have the ACLU Nazi case in Skokie. We had WBAI in trouble for playing the George Carlin Seven Dirty Words. Before that, the anti-Semitic poem read by Julius Lester. There was so many of these cases where the H-bomb Progressive Magazine case, which was a difficult one for a lot of people, where it's very hard to arouse public sympathy for it.
Well, that's the wisdom and the genius of the First Amendment, and particularly as interpreted by the Hughes Brandeis Holmes Court, that it is, as the Times editorial says today, a monument to muck. That you don't need a First Amendment for great, responsible journalists, for people who are always responsible. You don't need anything like that for them. What you need it for are the sleazy people, or occasionally for the great broadcaster or the great newspaper who breaks something that the government doesn't want them to do. There's a marvelous line from Charles Evans Hughes in Near versus Minnesota 50 years ago this week that says there will always be miscreant purveyors of gossip and rumor and smut. But what we believe in this country is that it's worth having a few noxious branches, which he borrowed from Madison, to let the tree of liberty grow strong. And that's why there's a line of Frankfurt is that the great civil rights have been won by not very nice people.
And there's been many cases to this day where the important breaking point came from the 20th century versions of the Saturday Press. I remember the Kerner case.
Right.
Was started by, there's a young man out there who would make all kinds of wild charges and would spend the whole day calling radio and TV stations, making charges against people, and initially one of his things was Kerner. And he was only right maybe 30% of the time, but when he was right, it was important.
Well, what's important is if somebody is wrong all the time, or just a lousy journalist, the marketplace will drive them out of business. You don't need the government to do that. And you take a terrible risk letting a single judge decide what's accurate, what's fair, and what isn't. In Near versus Minnesota, 50 years ago, there was this two noxious scandal sheets. The one in Duluth wasn't so bad, the Duluth Ripsaw. The Saturday Press was, seemed pretty bad. The newspapers engineered, manipulated the legislators into passing a law that would make it possible for a single judge gag a newspaper. What turns out, after my 3 or 4 years of investigation, is that almost everything that Near wrote, and just about everything that the Ruth Ripsaw wrote about gangsters and bootleggers infiltrating and manipulating politicians and policemen, was true. Mm-hmm. Now, you can't expect a judge to know whether it's true or not at that time. And sometimes the journalist may be wrong. If he's wrong enough of the time, people stop listening to him. But what we've bet on in this country is that the marketplace is the place to test that, not the courtroom. And I think it's very interesting, as I go back to Minnesota, and I've been commuting to there for the last 3 or 4 years of my life, is that the gangsters, many of whom were Jews, I'm sorry that the Saturday Press was an anti-Semitic paper and kept saying it's Jew. That happens to be very bad journalism and ethnicity and all that doesn't matter any more than if they were black or Italians or anything else. But they did happen to be Jews, bootleggers, immigrants. And they were manipulating the politicians and the cops. And that should have been reported. And if it hurt at the time, that's the price you got to pay. Not my kind of journalism, but I think the First Amendment... There's a marvelous moment, if I don't bore you with this, in the oral arguments in the Supreme Court 50 years ago, where Brandeis, himself a Jew, first Jew on the court, and vilified and almost kept off the court because of his ethnicity.
Mm-hmm.
And a great believer in privacy. And there they are in the Supreme Court, old chamber, and Brandeis says to the Deputy Attorney General representing Minnesota. Well, wasn't what these newspapers were printing, wasn't the relationship of gangsters to police, to politicians, isn't that what newspapers are supposed to do? And the Attorney General from Minnesota says, if it were true. And Brandeis says, even if it weren't true, or words to that effect, even if it weren't, they have a right to print it. You can sue them for libel afterwards if you want. And he says, but they were blackmailers. Sue them for blackmailing. They were extortionists. Then, in effect, sue them for extortion. But you cannot have a previous restraint. That comes from Blackstone, as you know, and it's interpreted in this case, 50 years old, that says you can punish somebody after the event, although our libel laws are the freest in the world today, and I think the best in the world, but you can't stop them in advance. And that's the genius of the American system and this decision that's 50 years old.
Let me interject a couple of questions before we lose our studio space. we have an incident. We still have muckrakers around the
yes,
National Enquirer and the Carol Burnett
case. I like
case.
To think you have muckrakers at CBS News and at WCBS.
You had mentioned that there are other aspects, other ways of attacking the press.
Right.
That. What about the case such as Carol Burnett and an obviously sleazy magazine such as the National Enquirer?
You're not
Enquirer.
Going to get me to either defend or to attack the National Enquirer. I don't happen to read it. I read it once to see what they said about Carol Burnett. I think that verdict against this marvelous actress, whom I admire a great deal, particularly for her performance in Friendly Fire about the Vietnam War, I think awarding punitive damages of $1,250,000, compensatory damages to somebody who's hurt, their employment is hurt, I understand that. But punitive damages of $1,250,000, thank God a judge knocked that down. Something obscene, something wrong about that. What they're doing is they're not punishing the National Enquirer for what they wrote, but for what they are. And in America, you don't punish people for what they are. I think we have to be very careful about letting libel, punitive libel, take the place of a prior restraint. Now, the National Enquirer, I am told, has got the money to pay that. But other newspapers and radio stations and small television stations will hear about that. And their lawyers and their management and their bankers will say, the next time there's a tough story about a scandal in Delia, Iowa, or any small town that you could name, gee, we can't afford to run this. And the journalist can say it's true, and I can prove it's true, et cetera, et cetera, and they'll say, yes, but how do you know your sources are going to be willing to come forth when it's a libel case? Let's not print that. And that's what's so chilling about punitive damages of $1,250,000. I'm sorry, and I will probably offend some of your listeners, but I'm not defending the National Enquirer when I say that. I'm defending the American people when I say we don't have a system where somebody can be fined $1,250,000, can be punished to that extent for what they write. Compensatory damages? Yes.
Let's go back a few years to some non-First Amendment questions, if you don't mind. Long about 1966, you wrote in Due to Circumstances Beyond Our Control that you accused the FCC of failing to understand what you said was the true meaning of television. Can you summarize for our listeners what you meant by that?
Well, I've always called the FCC a power of jello, because I don't think they've understood what broadcast journalism is about. I've changed my judgment a little about that, because I do think that although licensees, radio and television, including this one, who enjoy a very special privileges, and when I started in Providence, there were only two radio stations. There's only two television stations there now. We don't all have the abundancy of 60 stations as we do in New York and 60 radio stations. A lot of television stations. That you have the only platform in town, the only microphone in town. And that if there could have been a way to make the broadcasters do their best, I'm not talking about censorship or controlling what they say, but just spending enough time on what they promise to do. You apply for a license, that's the way you get a radio station or a television license. You tell them what you're going to do. And if you welch on that promise, I think you ought to lose your license. But the FCC has been so politicized that I don't think that's ever going to work. One license was taken away in Jackson, Mississippi, WLBT-TV, which never let a black person speak on there during the segregation thing. I wrote about that in another book. But for the most part, regulation isn't going to work. And I think now that we have almost 9,000 radio stations, and soon we're going to have a lot more television channels. They may not be VHF 2, 9, 13 and all that. But with cable and laser beams and satellites, I think decontrol is coming. And maybe we can have the open marketplace of ideas.
Well, radio is essentially decontrolled now.
Not quite, but more and more. And I think that's healthy. I think we have all news stations.
Well, that leads me to my next question, because in due to circumstances, you were extolling the virtues of satellites and how everything is going to be changed.
Right. And I think a lot of that has come about.
Not only that, it's gone even further. You mentioned a moment ago about the cable TV systems, which may sound the death knell to traditional networks as we know them.
It could be, and over-the-air broadcasting.
This gives stations, this gives people many more opportunities to reach television news
that
they never had before.
Right. Well, that's what this country is all about, the open, Brandeis, the open marketplace of ideas. Many of those opinions, by the way, were said in dissent. I grew up in Providence and New York City, 110th Street, right near Columbia, where I now teach. My father could send me out to buy 15 newspapers, 2 cents each. Great freedom of choice. And he could buy the Sun if he wanted a conservative paper, or he could buy the Post or the Times. Times was not sort of down the middle in those days, as it is now. Or he could the Post, a liberal paper. Now, what do you have in New York? We have 2.5 newspapers. And that's wrong. I mean, the whole idea, it's wrong.
Not only is it wrong, it's scary, because not only are there so few newspapers, most radio and television stations don't focus on gathering news the way these, even though many of these papers were second-rate, you know, the banner headlines and so forth. But
the
broadcasters don't focus on the news-gathering aspects as the newspapers do, did.
No, and that's why I don't want to appear to be apple-polishing my hosts. My day starts with WCBS Radio, 6:55. Sometimes I think the stories are too short. Sometimes I think you recycle the news too quickly. Can't expect a compliment without a crack. But I think the all-news station is a very useful thing in a society that gets so much of its news from broadcasting. I hope it gets that way with television soon. I think it is obscene to try to do the nightly news on the networks for 22 minutes. Because the American people who don't spend a day in a newsroom believe that that 22 minutes represents everything that's happening in the world.
Mm-hmm.
They don't read a newspaper. Television news is an index. I think local television news, something that keeps me awake at night, because I think the coiffured hair and the anchor man laughing with the weather lady, and the weather lady laughing with the sports thing. We've let style and vaudeville take the place of substance. We did not fight for, I don't mean me, I mean this nation. We did not fight for freedom of the press. And I mean by that freedom of the press for newspapers and magazines and radio and television, to have it end up as a vaudeville joke in which news is a very famous broadcaster who shall be nameless. Once said to me, he's no longer in the business, said to me, I'm not a journalist like your friends Murrow or Cronkite or Severide. He said, I'm just an entertainer. I tell jokes, they tell news. If that's what we let this freedom become, then that pendulum that gave us freedom of the press, which we're celebrating today, could swing the other way.
Fred Friendly, how badly has the credibility of the news media been sustained by or affected by the Janet Cook case and by the Michael Daley case?
Well, they're two different cases. Michael Daley happens to be a very good journalist. I don't understand how his editors let him pipe those stories. That's a term of art that both you know, which means invent a quote or embroider a story. The Janet Cook thing is an aberration. Very complex. I don't pretend to understand that the Washington Post has written everything you can write about that. But I suppose that in the short term, those stories hurt. People say, how do we know Watergate is true? How do we know the sources on that were accurate? Actually, there's no source. And the Janet Cook Washington Post thing is not a source story, because if she would lie about that story, as they say she did, and as I assume she did, she could have lied about the source. She could have said the source is John Brown or John Jones just as easily as that. In the short term, that story and the Daily News story and another story that involved the New York Times syndicate service, not the New York Times, hurt like the devil. I cried about the Janet Cook story, and I don't cry very often. In the long haul, I think it may be beneficial. I think every generation or so, you'll got to learn, as Murrow once said, not to get too big for your britches. And I think we had a very heady wine, journalism, through the Watergate period. I think we need a sense of awe for all our freedoms, because this is an awesome responsibility. So I think in answer to your question, Mr. Swain, that it's probably short-term harmful. It's embarrassing to be
So the news people are going to be looking at themselves a lot more.
Yeah, but I think that's very healthy. And I think that every good editor ought to have what Ernest Hemingway called a foolproof crap detector. I cleaned that up a little bit. I like to think, I would hope that if I'm remembered at all, and I probably won't be, I would be remembered for those stories which, for reasons I never could explain, I killed as much as those stories that I helped to put on the air. I do not understand how anybody let the Janet Cook story get into the newspaper. And the more you read what the ombudsman writes, what I don't understand is why one editor didn't go marching in to one of the big editors of the Washington Post, Howard Simons, perhaps the best newspaper editor in the country, or Ben Bradley, whom everybody remembers from All the President's Men, and say, look, you may want to run this story, and it may be the best story in the world about this 8-year-old alleged junkie, but I want to talk to you about some doubts I have on it. I would like to think that here at this news operation, or the news operation that I used to run, that that's what makes for good journalism, is a little cynicism, a little itching powder. Heywood Broun said, what all journalists need is a certain itching powder. I don't think we need to be cynics so much as skeptics, and particularly about a story like that. And I think the Washington Post has said everything you can say about it. I hope it vaccinates every editor. Because editing is for editing, as the Supreme Court has said, but it also means you take a very hard look at a story like that. I don't know how that one got through. It hurts everybody in the short term. In the long haul,
I can't let you go without asking you your thoughts about a form of journalism that is caused a lot of, ruffled a lot of feathers, this confrontation journalism or ambush journalism that Mike Wallace has practiced and other local...
Well, Mike Wallace a lot less than Geraldo Rivera. Mm-hmm. I don't mind saying names. What you're talking about, if we can take it away from names, is the business of waiting for someone to come out of a building to get in his car, her car, and then grabbing them when they're unprepared. I think that's unconscionable. I think the only time that that's permissible is if you've tried to interview somebody, written them a letter, called them up on the telephone, no, they're part of this investigative report you're doing, they're unavailable, they won't do it. Then you have a responsibility to try to do that. But too often, they don't even try to do that. They would rather, because it's good for pictures, because it's dramatic, because it shows the reporter as Mr. Good Guy, and the subject under investigation as the bad guy trying to get away in a furtive way. And that is really using television in a punitive way against an unsuspecting man. We don't let a policeman do that. A policeman under the Miranda warning, Supreme Court again, if Fred Friendly is arrested for drunk and driving or molesting somebody or stealing or something, the policeman is obliged to say, Mr. Friendly, you're under arrest. Before you say anything, I'm obliged to tell you, you have a right to talk to your lawyer. Anything you may say may be used against you. So now, you can say that a journalist is not a police legally, but ethically, we have the same responsibility. So what you call ambush or confrontation interviewing, I think, is permissible only if you have exhausted every other means of getting that person to talk.
There's something about the need for pictures that seems to have engendered it in TV. And using an example from Geraldo, as a matter of fact, when he was still at Channel 7.
Former student of mine, I got to admit to that.
Okay. Well, I remember there was a story about the mistreatment of illegal aliens or whatever you want to say, in New Jersey.
Right.
And I still remember the story. Geraldo and a Channel 7 news crew in two station wagons pulling up to the gate of this farm, demanding to be let in, not being let in, and this great confrontation, great film and all that. At the same time, two newspaper reporters had disguised themselves as farm workers and had gotten in there, stayed there for 2 weeks, and written a great story. Geraldo is remembered for the confrontation. The two reporters' names have probably been forgotten, but the thing
they may
was,
be remembered for the journalism.
Hopefully. Yeah. But they got the story, and what is, to me, as bad about confrontation journalism, as besides the fact that it's unfair, is very often it is done instead of something that gets the story because you can do a picture with it, or you can self-aggrandize with it.
Well, we forget, as Carl Sandburg said, we forget where we came from. We have only one job. You as working journalists, me as someone in the, I as somebody in the springtime of my senility. I'm flunking retirement, as you can see. We have one job, to explain complex issues, whether it's about crime or whether it's about productivity or whether it's about El Salvador. The newspaper man works with a one-ounce pencil. You in radio work with a 20-pound pencil, tape recorder and a microphone. Mm. Television, I used to call it a 1,000-pound pencil. It's a little smaller than that now. The only possible reason for using that is to get the story, not to show how to do it. Murrow used to say occasionally when I would lean a little bit, not in the direction of confrontation, but he used to say, your tripod is showing, Fritzel. The word I hated, and he used to call me that when he was rapping my knuckles a little bit. You can't let your tripod show. And what he meant by that is, speaking metaphorically, the means by which you do it are unimportant. You are an explainer of complex issues. You can't explain it unless you can understand it. You may have to go to a library to understand it. You may have to look at dirty, musty old court records to understand it. You may have to spend months talking to somebody, interviewing somebody. You don't understand it any better with a frontal attack on a place and say, let me in, I am a member of the press. That's showboating. And I'll tell you, it's not only unfair. If you do enough of it, be like the quiz scandals, which I remember from 1959 and 60. People begin to lose credibility in this. They don't want us to be million-dollar anchor men. They don't want us to be handsome people, members of the upper establishment. They want us to be somebody who, in our 8 or 16-hour-a-day job, spend our time explaining and investigating what they don't have time to do. The world we live in, the image of reality, why the subways don't run, why poor people can't get a job, why Johnny can't read or Jane can't read, why there can be something like drug addiction, why we can't stop it, why our streets are dirty, why our farmers can't get enough money, why the space program is important. That's what they want to know. That's the most serious, most marvelous calling you could have. I tell you, I'm 65 and a half years old. I've been a journalist ever since I've been 20 years old. For all of those 45 years, I thank God that I've been lucky enough to do something as useful as that, and which is as much fun. Because what a journalist gets to do is to harness his or her curiosity. What higher calling could there be than that? What more do you want to be?
Have you ever regretted your leaving CBS News in the way you did?
Sure. That doesn't mean that it was wrong to do. I had no choice. It's a complicated thing that we'll have time to go
into. We'll save another broadcast.
Right. But I had, as you just could gather from what I said, I was an executive producer working with some of the best broadcasters who ever worked in this profession. I was head of a news organization, which is still one of the two or three best news organizations in print or broadcast in the world, CBS News. I loved it. I think one of the reasons that the people I was having my confrontation with thought I was probably bluffing is they thought I could never walk away from that job, not because of the money, but because of the fulfillment it gave me. And I miss that terribly. That's why I write books.
How's it feel being back?
It's nice to come into this building. It's only the second or third time I've been here since I left here. I left, to paraphrase something a teacher of mine said, I left all of my youth and much of my heart here. And every time CBS or WCBS does well, I quell, to use this ethnic word, and every time you stumble, I bleed. Although,
thank you.